You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a close look at the way Wisconsin state tax money goes to local governments. Governor Evers and state Republican leaders have different plans. We'll find out how they could affect communities around the state. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about baseball.
The early 1940s saw the rise of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
An All-American pastime, baseball, brings out the All-American Girl Baseball League for spring training at Alexandria, Virginia. Two teams are working out, the Fort Wayne Daisies and the Racine Belles, getting in shape for an opening day doubleheader.
Author Dean Robbins tells us about a memorable moment from the league's historic run.
A major event in sports history took place in September 1943. Two teams played in the first championship series of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Both were from Wisconsin.
Okay, gals, play ball.
The league was founded that year to keep fans coming to ballparks while male players served in World War II. It held tryouts for women around the United States and Canada and picked top prospects for the first four teams, the Racine Belles, Kenosha Comets, Rockford Peaches, and South Bend Blue Sox. The female athletes had the rare opportunity to get decent salaries, play for big crowds, and bask in media attention.
These league champions play 126 games a season and earn up to $100 a week. Nice going, girls.
Unfortunately, there was no avoiding 1940s-style sexism. The women had to follow strict rules for grooming and manners. They were even forced to wear ladylike uniforms, including short skirts that offered no protection for their legs when sliding into bases.
Jean Bunsett, the squeeze is on. Tibby Eisen slides home with a run and a nicely bruised leg. Better a bruise than long pants, eh, gals?
At first, the public viewed the women as mere novelties. But fans soon realized that these were serious ballplayers, according to the Racine Belle, Sophie Curis. She shared this in an interview with Grand Valley State University.
You know, we were a curiosity to begin with. And then when they came out and saw that we could really play, then they came out in droves and we did really well.
The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League proved popular in Wisconsin. Kenosha's Helen Nicole emerged as the 1943 season's best pitcher, with 31 wins and 220 strikeouts. In the All-Wisconsin Championship Series that fall, the Belles bested the Comets in three straight games, with Racine catcher Irene Hickson batting a torrid .417. The league expanded to 10 teams, and attendance rose to nearly a million in 1948. But recruiting new players proved difficult, and owners cut back on expenses. In 1954, they shut down the operation amid a backlash against women playing baseball. But the players had made their mark, paving the way for other women's professional leagues. And even though it took a while, they got their due. They were honored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and memorialized in Hollywood's A League of Their Own. Joyce Barnes McCoy pitched for the Kenosha Comets in 1943. Here she is describing her appearance decades later at a ball game in her native Hutchinson, Kansas.
Oh, they asked me to come and throw out a pitch, and when they introduced me, I stood up, and that whole grandstand was alive, was yelling and hollering. And so I waved, took my hat, waved at them, and then they started in again. And all the umpires and things, they took their hats off, and I had to autograph everything.
Yes, hats off to Joyce Barnes McCoy and other Wisconsin players from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It's good to know that, by the end of their lives, they finally had a chance to feel like All-American legends.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, Republican State Assembly leaders released their proposal last week for updating the state's shared revenue system. That system determines the amount of state tax money that is redistributed back to local municipalities. The current shared revenue structure has remained relatively stagnant since the early 2000s, but the demographics of townships, cities, and counties around the state have changed a lot over the time. The Republican proposal has gotten some pushback from state and local leaders who say the funding increases aren't enough and they come with a lot of restrictions on how the money could be used. Governor Tony Evers previously proposed his own changes to the state shared revenue system and said last week he would veto the Republican plan as it currently stands.
The state must step up more than what I've seen. It's why I can't support the Republican plan as is, and frankly, I'll veto it in its entirety. It is not enough resources. We have the resources to do it. Let's increase the money that's going to the locals. And frankly, also let's kind of remove all those restrictions that the legislation was putting on those local folks.
The Republican proposal is still in draft form. It could be tweaked before lawmakers vote on it. Our next guest broke down the numbers in both plans to see what they meant for communities around the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about state shared revenue and the Republican proposal? Do you want to see the state government increase the flow of funding back to local governments? If so, how should the money be divided? Should there be strings attached on what local governments can do with that money? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Philip Bracco is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He wrote analyses of the Republican state shared revenue proposal and Governor Evers' proposal on the blog The Recombobulation Area. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be with you, Rob.
Let's talk about the concept of shared revenue. Sometimes I think it's portrayed as the state is giving money to local communities. People think of it differently, though. It's tax money that's collected in local communities in the first place. How should we think about shared revenue?
Yeah, so if you think about the history of shared revenue, the state starts doing this in 1911. And that year is important because that's also the year that the state preempts local governments from assessing income tax. And it enacts a number of property tax exemptions for the first time. And so basically what shared revenue is doing is the state saying, look, we're in control of all of these local units of government. We are taking away a source of revenue liquidity for you, really important sources of revenue. And so what we're doing is we're going to give back some of that revenue that we're essentially preempting you from taking advantage of. And the formula by which the state's done that has changed a little bit over the years. We really haven't updated the amounts that local governments are getting since the early 2000s. But the basic idea is a return of revenue to local communities rather than, I like to say, it's not a gift. Right, it is a return of revenue to counties and municipalities around the state.
There's a lot of differences between the two parties, but it does seem like there's general consensus, Phil, that something needs to change. Why is that?
Well, I think the consensus that you see has been built up over the last few decades, where essentially the state has allowed the payment that local governments receive to remain flat, even though inflation is increasing every year, and even though the revenues that local communities are sending back to Madison or to the state government are increasing every year, the money has stayed flat. So, for example, right, if Milwaukee were to get what it sort of in inflation-adjusted terms, what it was owed, compared to 2001, right, it would be receiving about $400 million rather than $200-some million that it's receiving today. And so, you know, you can see that there's been demand for local governments. Every single legislative session, they sort of put these sort of demands up. But really, the state legislature has been pretty unwilling to move on those until this year. And so the thing that holds the governor and the state legislature's proposals in common is that they both represent an adjustment to to that formula, reintroducing a formula so that it updates every year. But that's really where the similarities between the two proposals end. In almost every other important respect, and we can talk about what those are, those two plans are pretty different.
Yeah, they get pretty complicated, but can you talk about kind of which communities gain the most from one proposal versus the other? Who are the winners and losers in the governor's plan versus the Republican plan?
Well, let's just start by talking about the size and scale of the two plans, right? Under Evers' proposal, the governor would allocate about $576 million additional dollars in state revenue aid or local revenue aid. The assembly bill is about half that, right? $277 million. So already when we're thinking about what's different between the two proposals, it's not just the distribution formula, how the money moves mm-hmm. around the state. It's just the amount of money overall. And so you've seen complaints from everybody from local officials in Milwaukee County to officials in Waukesha County, very different politically, but complaints about the overall size of the package. Now, the other thing that's important is the mathematical formula that's used to allocate that aid, right? So for a very long time, the formula that the state used said, look, we're going to give back money based on kind of the amount of revenue effort that you're putting in and the overall property value. So the idea was like tax-based equalization as well as your population. The governor's proposal kind of reintroduces that formula again. So it's basically kind of restoring it to what it would have been in the early 2000s, kind of where we left off last. The Republican formula is pretty different. It takes out that aidable revenue component entirely. So that component that's based on property tax values and revenue effort, and replaces it with a formula that varies. There's a formula for counties that is so complicated that I can't even really get into it on the radio. It is in fact too complicated for that. But for municipalities, the formula differs depending on the size of your municipality. So if you are a municipality with like less than 5,000 people, you have a little bit higher population multiplier. There's like a number that the population is multiplied by than larger cities. And what that means is that as a percentage of what they're getting now, local, very, very small municipalities, give an example of Popple River, which is, I think, in Forest County. It has a population of something like 43 people. I mean, it's going to see something like a 5,000% increase over what it's getting now, which is great for Popple River, by the way. By contrast, if you look at what a city like Milwaukee or Racine or Green Bay or La Crosse is going to be getting, they're going to be getting just about 10% more than they're getting now. So, you know, the idea of the Republicans kind of proposal is like every community is going to get at least 10% more. But some communities, and particularly the smallest municipalities in the state, are going to get a lot more in a number of cases. It's like over 1,000% more than they're getting today.
Talking to Marquette University political science professor Phil Rocco about proposed changes to the state shared revenue system and what it would mean for communities big and small around Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this and what you've seen in the news so far? If you are closely involved in local budgets at whatever level, what do you want to see change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Phil Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to discuss the proposal by Republican lawmakers to update the state's shared revenue system with new funding and new limitations for local governments, how it stacks up against Governor Evers' plan. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Stephen is with us in Mount Pleasant. Stephen, hi.
Hello. The quota requirement to receive shared revenue Is that going to be seasonal, monthly, yearly? I don't understand how this is going to be placed, because this could have a drastic effect on off-season up north, where there's no tourists, and all of a sudden you have to start busing the locals for being 2 miles an hour over the limit.
Oh, Stephen, it sounds like you're talking about police quotas. There were some strings involving either police numbers or their traffic violation quotas. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephen. Phil, Stephen taking us into some of the strings attached. And yes, some of the funding is contingent on providing proof that you're not cutting back on police services in a community.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of differences here. So the governor's proposal, we'll just begin with what the new money can be used for. About 56% of the governor's proposal is just general revenue. That's kind of what's local governments have been used to getting from the state. It reserves 45% for public safety. With the Republican proposal, 100% of the aid is restricted for either public safety, EMS, or fire. So it's not general money. I want to make that clear at the outset. Then beyond that, there are a bunch of additional restrictions or strings attached to that. One of the strings I think that's gotten the most attracted the most controversy is this idea that in order to get the new money, local governments have to spend or contribute the same amount of effort, and that means a couple different things, to policing and other services that they did in the prior year. And the kinds of evidence that the governments can provide, that there's sort of four different criteria, and they have to provide evidence of two of them, is like you're spending the same, you have the same number of sworn officers. And then the ones that have attracted the most controversy are you're making the same number of arrests, or you are doing the same number of moving violations. And obviously, that's, I think, those two things in particular have attracted controversy, because there is currently a law on the books in Wisconsin that prohibits arrest quotas. But even if that's kind of out the door, the idea that you have to, that the state is going to determine kind of artificially, like what you should be spending on different categories of expenditures, I mean, that's attracted a lot of conflict and controversy from local officials around the state.
Thanks a lot for that call, Stephen. And Phil, it's not just police. There are a lot of concerns about various places where local leaders say, hang on, you're stepping on local control. Advisory referenda, I believe, go away. What other restrictions are you seeing concern about there?
Yeah, so there's some things like the prohibition on advisory referenda. So now under the Republican proposal, local governments would not be allowed to have advisory referenda on the ballot, which has attracted some controversy. There's some other things that are just preemption. So preventing local public health officials from issuing orders in the event of a pandemic kind of event, unless they get special political approval for doing that. A preemption on local regulations of quarries, as well as for Milwaukee City and County, a whole host of other restrictions. So limiting what Milwaukee City and County can spend on arts funding, requiring a 2/3 vote of city and county legislative bodies in order to approve new spending, preventing the city from spending any levy money on a streetcar. I mean, it is a very high level of state control that the Assembly's bill is asking local governments to you know, give up autonomy in exchange for an amount of money that's about half what they would get under Evers' proposal.
Phil, as I mentioned, the Republican draft is a draft, so Republicans could change it. As I also mentioned, Governor Evers could veto the whole thing. If we just ride with the current budget and the current shared revenue plan, what are your concerns about what that would mean for communities around the state?
Well, right. And I think this is the sort of the bargaining situation that we're in right now. In a way, the status quo, especially for larger cities, is pretty unsustainable, right? And so, you know, in traditional legislative bargaining, if there is a status quo that is like really unacceptable and you can't get a better deal, you'd expect the parties to kind of accept the take it or leave it offer. The issue here, and I think the reason why Evers threatened to veto the legislation, and I think why the veto threat is credible, is that a shared revenue measure that has a lot of strings attached that really fundamentally changes the logic of the program that had been in place for many, many years, and has unintended consequences that really haven't at this point even been analyzed. I think he's banking on the idea that that threat is credible because those kinds of restrictions are very unpopular across the state. And I think that it is possible that that could advance some bargaining. And if you look at the current kind of what lobbyist principals have kind of the positions they've registered on the bill, you know, it's not like all of the local governments have registered unequivocal support. 64% of the government of the lobbyists on the legislation have registered their stand as others. So neither oppose entirely nor support entirely. They all have sort of problems. Many of them have problems with it. There are some unequivocal supporters, and then there are some unequivocal opponents. So I think that does set up conditions of possibility for bargaining here. Although the one thing to note is that the governor's veto threat here is a full veto threat because Republicans have styled this as a standalone bill rather than being part of the budget. The very strong veto pen that Evers traditionally wields in the budget process will not, the line item veto will not apply to this.
Thanks to Phil Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We took a look at state shared revenue proposals. Tomorrow on Central Time, managing angry people with a Wisconsin psychologist. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, a related note, the Joint Finance Committee has made its first moves on the next state budget. We'll talk to Democratic Committee member Senator LaTanya Johnson about her priorities and the state legislature's relationship with Milwaukee. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we dig into the ethical standards for U.S. Supreme Court justices, how they compare to lower courts, and the impact they could have on our justice system. First, every piece of legislation having to do with taxation, revenue, and how money gets spent by our state government has to go through the 16-member Joint Finance Committee of the state legislature. That includes Wisconsin's two-year state budget. Democratic Governor Tony Evers introduced his third budget proposal in February. For the third time now, the Republican majority on the Joint Finance Committee started deliberations by rejecting a long list of the governor's initiatives. Last week, the committee took its first actions on the next state budget. In a 12-4 party line vote, it removed 545 of those proposals. If lawmakers and the governor don't reach a new budget agreement by July 1st, state spending would continue at levels set in the current state budget. Wisconsin is expected to end its fiscal year with a surplus of more than $7 billion. One of the four Democratic members of the powerful Joint Finance Committee joins us now. We have invitations out to Republican members as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the state budget is built? What are your priorities for spending in Wisconsin? What do you want state lawmakers to consider before agreeing to a spending plan? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. LaTanya Johnson has represented the 6th State Senate District in Milwaukee since 2017. Before that, she served in the State Assembly. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're on this Joint Finance Committee. Like the legislature at whole, there's a solid Republican majority. What do you think of your role? How do you see your role as a member of the four in that 12-4 division?
Well, basically being on Joint Finance, especially when you have numbers that low compared to my 12 Republican colleagues, basically your role is to be the voice, to use your words to try and get the message across, especially regarding the governor's budget, why that budget was important, why it's significant, and why so many people across the state had input in that budget and wanted to see things implemented.
The budget covers a lot of ground, and the 545 items removed from the governor's budget by Joint Finance last week had a lot of different elements. I want to start with gun control and gun safety measures. Your Republican colleagues removed a lot of those. Some of them, they said, because they weren't a budget item, because they were separate, you know, guns and safety items, not part of the budget. Were you sorry to see those removed from the budget?
I was extremely sorry to see those items removed from the budget, especially being from Milwaukee, because we have so much gun violence here. You know, in warmer months, people look forward to the summers just simply because they get to shed the layers. But here in Milwaukee, we don't necessarily look forward to the summers because we know that that's going to come with an extra level of gun violence. And the items that the governor put in the budget were basically the bare minimum, the things that people agreed with, like universal background checks. We know that 79% of Wisconsin voters say that they support having background checks for the sale of firearms, the extreme risk protection order. We know that, you know, individuals support having guns removed from individuals, especially in times of need concerning their mental health. So those were just some of the things that were removed. But other items that did have a physical impact were the sales tax exemption for gun safes and trigger locks and gun barrel locks. We know that those things are equally as important. And being able to remove the taxes from those items, you know, would kind of assure that they are affordable for everyone, especially in terms of being able to secure something as safe as a firearm.
Do you have any hope that some of those items might come up as separate pieces of legislation and have a chance at bipartisan support?
I would love to see these items come up as standalone bills. Unfortunately, that's not what we've seen in the past. When it comes to any type of movement in terms of trying to restrict or just trying to make it just a little bit more difficult for individuals who shouldn't possess guns to not be able to get them, we continue to have pushback from my Republican colleagues. The very thing that they're fighting for, the Second Amendment, for the majority of law-abiding citizens, they would have no problem passing a background check. So those individuals would not be affected. But the federal government has a very dangerous loophole when it comes to being able to purchase a gun. And basically that federal loophole allows guns to be purchased at gun shows or through online vendors without background checks. So that means that if you are a convicted felon and you're in search of a gun, you could buy one from online, from armslist.com, and they're not going to ask you if you're a convicted felon. They're not going to run a background check. They're just going to sell you the firearm. We know the majority of people are law-abiding citizens. So if there was a law in place that said all gun purchases had to go through a background check, we would see that happen. But unfortunately, that loophole allows people to get away with purchasing guns and not having to disclose the fact that they shouldn't have them.
Talking to State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, member of the state's Joint Finance Committee, about the two-year budget plan currently in the works in the state legislature. We've been talking about some firearms provisions removed by Republican leaders from Democratic Governor Tony Evers' budget. There's a lot more to it that we're going to get into. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. My comment would be, every time there's a surplus, the whole thing about giving tax refunds becomes kind of a political football. And I just kind of see it as short-term pandering that kind of sets the wealthy against the rest of us in terms of who's getting it. So I would rather see any budget surpluses be put into long-term beneficial things like energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, things that benefit the whole state instead of just becoming another political football. And thanks for your time. I appreciate you.
Jordan, thanks a lot for calling in. Senator Johnson, Governor Evers' original budget plan had some tax cuts in it. Republicans also looking for that as well. What do you think about that question about how to balance what to do with the surplus between tax relief versus investing in, as Jordan said, things like infrastructure?
I completely agree with that 100%. There are better things that we could be doing with those tax dollars that would, you know, generate long-term gain for the state. One of the things that was pulled out of the budget that I was extremely sad to see go was the tuition promise. We all know how expensive college is right now for our young people and their families. And for that very reason, so many just smart, intelligent young minds don't get to go on to higher education. The tuition promise would have allowed children whose families made gross under $62,000 to go to college for free. Now, that didn't include room and board. That was just tuition. But the important aspect of that is that we know that we have a worker shortage right now. And we also know that those immediate fixes are not going to work. We know as a state that that worker shortage is going to continually get worse, especially by 2035. So allowing these kids the opportunity to stay here at home, to go to college here at home, and to have that tuition paid means that we're going to have a more educated workforce. It's going to be better for innovation. It's going to be better for those higher paying jobs to come into the state. And it helps us keep our talent right here at home. The one thing that we know is that over these last 10 years, we have had a zero net gain in terms of immigration, meaning there have been more people leaving this state than we have had coming into this state. And that is a huge problem. We didn't start to see just a little bit of an uptick of people moving into the state until after 2020, which was around 2021. What the state doesn't know is if these individuals were moving to Wisconsin because of work, or if it was the younger people who were moving back home because of the pandemic. But either way it goes, the state cannot continue to function with our residents making a mass exodus for the border, because we will continue to see that worker shortage and it won't benefit the state at all.
Jordan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Wisconsin State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, member of the Joint Finance Committee, taking a look at the ongoing state budget deliberations, what some key proposals mean for the state and for Milwaukee in particular. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to look at shared revenue, how state tax money flows back to local communities, what it means for communities around the state, and some special rules for what might happen in Milwaukee. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wisconsin Democratic State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee. We're talking about her role on the powerful Joint Finance Committee, the Republican proposal to increase state funding for local governments with some strings attached, and her top priorities from Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your top priorities when it comes to the way that state receives and spends money? What do you need in your community? What are you watching most closely that you think affects your neighborhood, your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Senator Johnson, Republicans released last week a plan aimed at increasing state funding to local governments by at least 10% in every community. But there's a lot of details, subject of a whole nother conversation on the show today. In Milwaukee in particular, what do you see their proposal doing?
So the proposal for shared revenue for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County is full of a lot of uncertainty. And I'm not confident that the bill that we see now from the assembly would actually make Milwaukee whole. As a matter of fact, this bill has more poison pills from what I see than I would care to understand. For example, the Police and Fire Commission, we all know the issues that regarding untrust in terms of the police department and the community. Well, the Fire and Police Commission, it basically helps to bridge that level of trust. It gives the community a place to file grievances, to go and have their issues heard, to try and make both fire and police better. Now, there are provisions in this shared budget that calls for additional members, one fire and one police retired individual that lives within the city of Milwaukee. That's not an issue. The concern is removing the policy and oversight from the Fire and Police Commission and giving it back to the fire and police chiefs. That is a no-go. That is exactly what we were trying to move away from, which was to make the whole process more transparent. Also, the two-thirds vote in order for any new spending, new resolutions, or new ordinances. What that basically does, it threatens to put a halt to government business unless it's a two-thirds of votes available. And that's not something that we're interested in. Also, no local referendums. That's a huge concern. The other piece for me, though, is that when we talk about shared revenue and making shared revenue make sense for the community, the numbers that are involved in this process makes absolutely no sense. For example, there is a community called Popple River here in Wisconsin. Popple River has a population of 43 individuals, right? So Popple River is going from $606 in shared revenue, which is understandable that an increase was definitely needed there. But then it's going to an increase of over, I believe it's going to an increase of over 5,000%. So it would go from $606 to $30,723. On average, that averages out to $729 per person. But you have a community or a county like Green Bay, which is in Brown County with a population of 107,000 individuals, and they only got a 10% increase, which averages out to $159 per person. The math does not make sense. And in Green Bay, you have Lambeau Field. The security that is required to cover that event, just like here in Milwaukee, when you go to a Brewers game or you go to a Bucks game, the city of Milwaukee puts that security cost. And so when you have these larger venues that contribute significantly more in terms of shared revenue, then that money should be sent back to those communities in a much similar basis. But this bill, the only thing that it has that makes sense is that the individuals who were sitting around that table making those decisions decided to give the areas that they represent more money. And that's unfair. The math does not make sense.
I want to key in on a particular item for Milwaukee. Now, some local leaders have been advocating for Milwaukee City and County to be able to raise a local sales tax there. That is included in this with, again, some strings attached, a local referendum required to raise those sale taxes and conditions, I believe, related to having to use them to pay off pension obligations. I want to give a listen to Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss speaking here to the Milwaukee Press Club on Friday.
I've seen the city's budget, and I've seen the county's budget, and the bad decisions made by somebody. I'm not going to cast, I don't know every decision made by everybody, but in the past they made a series of bad decisions that only really allow for one option. Either it's dramatic reductions in police and fire, which I think are bad for our region, or it's a tax increase. People are going to have to decide which is better.
What are your thoughts on the inclusion of a possible Milwaukee sales tax increase as it exists in this particular budget plan?
Okay, so the reality is that we are going to have to do an increased sales tax. We're going to have to do that. If we do not, Milwaukee will see insolvency on January 1st, 2025. That means that the city of Milwaukee will go bankrupt. Period. No discussion. End of topic. Now, the concern for me is that that sales tax is basically secured to paying the unfunded pension obligations that we have, predominantly for fire and police. That is one of the reasons that we are here, is because the fire and police pensions together make up 60% of the city's operational costs. I believe our operational cost is $721 million total. Police, $300 million, and fire is, I believe, somewhere around $157 million. So together, one is almost 40%, the other is 18%. So that's an issue. But the concern for me regarding this bill is that even with that 2% increase, it does not make the city of Milwaukee whole. It does not take away our deficit. In order for that deficit to be taken away, which will be roughly $156 million whole in 2024, we would need at least 2.1%. But the discouraging part of all of these poison pills that are in this bill is that the city will be expected to pay for audits, ongoing audits, one of which would be we would have to pay for an expenditure report. Then we would have to pay, that's annually. Then every 5 years, we would have to pay for an actuary audit. And then another audit from the Legislative Audit Bureau. There is no cost associated with those audits, so we don't know how much that's going to cost us. So that's an additional cost on top of what our deficit already is that's expected to be paid through shared revenue and this increased sales tax. The other thing is that the state wants Milwaukee Public School to hire 25 resource officers. Now, these resource officers are actual law enforcement officers. That is the requirement. But the city of Milwaukee is expected to pick up the cost for 2/3 of that cost. That's another additional cost that's being attached to our shared revenue and also to this sales tax. And there are a lot of other poison pills. So with the sales tax, we have to maintain the level of fire and police that we currently have right now. So if the sales tax generates any additional revenue on top of what they already anticipate the generated revenue to be, that money then has to go toward hiring more fire and police, at least up to 1,725 police officers and I believe 218 firefighters, right? The downside to that is that there are no provisions for if the shared revenue decreases. So if we find ourselves in a recession, there is nothing to protect us from that obligation, and that's the issue. The other issue is that they want this to go to a referendum. Now, in most cases, you want the community to decide if this is okay for them or not. But in Milwaukee's case, we do not have that time. The quickest that this could go to referendum without us calling for a special election would be in the spring of 2024. Then from that election, we have to give the Department of Revenue up to 120 days to make sure that they can start collecting the tax. We are facing insolvency January 1st, 2025. That does not give us enough time to make sure that we will not hit that cutoff window. The best thing to do is to not have this go to referendum, but to allow the Common Council and the county supervisors to take that vote.
And we'll leave it there. Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
LaTanya Johnson represents the 6th State Senate District in Milwaukee. She's a Democratic member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. She joined us for a look at the 2-year state budget plan. We have invites out also to Republican members of Joint Finance. Coming up, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold joins us to help explain the ethical standards in place for sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices and how they can affect the public's confidence in those courts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.